Okay, so I'd like to tell you about some work on fermionic coherence that we've been doing lately, give you some background on some things that I've been working with other people on regarding coherence, fermionic coherence, so on. I put the clocks in parentheses because I'm not going to talk about it so much, but coherence and clocks and timekeeping are very much related. So I think that the topics I'm going to discuss today are definitely in line with the workshop. Also, it's a workshop, and I think workshops are more fun if you give work in progress than work completed. And so I'm going to be talking about various things. Some things might be wrong, some things might be controversial, and just, you know, if anybody wants to interrupt or discuss along the way, that's fine with me. So, the work has been done with Thomas Pitts, who's visiting me from the Czech Republic. He's a collaborator I've had for a number of years, who's always happy to come over and work hard. And also Brett Hamilton, who just finished his first year at the University of Waterloo in physics. And he lives in Calgary, he's coming back again for his second year studies, and if anybody's interested, he's extremely talented, so I'm pretty much positive. What we've done with this work is we've approached it from more of a quantum optics perspective, recognizing how important this coherence is for optical systems. And then we've tried to address the issue of coherence for fermionic systems. And originally, the work really started with Steve Bartlett, and we did some collaboration with Yoshi Yamamoto and Will Oliver at Stanford University. And our interest was in interferometry using 2D electron gases, two-dimensional electron gases. And the idea in these systems is what's happening is these systems are becoming increasingly sophisticated. So they're now able to take two-dimensional electron gases, put in quantum point contacts and certain boundary conditions, and et cetera, and they're able to get interference, and they're able to see Hambury-Brown and Twist type effects, which are anti-bunching effects, and various other things. And now, to a quantum optics person, we're used to 40 years of knowledge and experiments done with respect to coherence and higher-order coherence. And one of the discussions we had at Stanford about this was that there wasn't necessarily the framework for discussing coherence with electrons. Now, I've got to be careful about this because, of course, there's a lot of years of working with correlation functions. So the electron community certainly has the tools to be able to calculate things and work out what's going to happen. There's no deficiency in terms of the theory. But where there's a little bit of an issue is in thinking about it, thinking about these electron beams, 2D electron gases and so on, as being coherent in the sense of quantum optics. So Steve and I and Yoshi and Morgan and Bill Oliver, we tried to develop some coherence theory for the electrons, had some successes, and there's also some issues that I won't go into so much. It's more background for this work. The interesting thing here is about clocks. And so we talk about shared reference frames, and John Smolin gave a talk yesterday he talked about the issues with the quantum teleportation experiment and the shared reference frame. And so over time, we mentioned the work I did with Terry Rudolph, and over time I've been thinking more about clocks and shared reference frames again in the context of coherence. And so there's something I like to think about here, and this is about clocks coming from fermions. I don't really think there's a clear answer out there yet, but in trying to trying to discuss time reference frames, there could be an issue. You know, like for one of the things that I guess we got from John Smolin's talk and get from reading the papers is that a lot of the issues about clocks and bosons are semantic issues. You know, that we're able, you know, it depends how we want to think of the shared reference frame and the clock, and so we're able to look at it from different perspectives. But somehow people can adopt different perspectives and reach the same conclusion that we can think about shared clocks. I don't think it's so simple for fermions. And so I'll be talking about these issues, but I won't come to any satisfactory conclusions. It's still work ongoing. Okay, so now, again, in John's talk yesterday, he talked about, he mentioned this sort of diagram, which was coherent states mixed over the circle. This diagram here represents a superposition of coherent states on the circle. And so, you know, what I'm showing you now is a mathematical formalism that gives us a solid concept of how we can do it, Okay, so we can take the density matrix, we can decompose into number states, we can decompose into coherent states. And now, to me, what number states and coherent states represent are representations. So coherent states and number states are just representations for what is really going on inside the system. So if I write down a density matrix that captures all the information I could possibly get with existing technology on the system, and I find that the density matrix can be written as a mixture of number states or a mixture of coherent states, this doesn't bother me anymore. It's just that I can decompose it two different ways. And as long as, you know, I can decompose everything in number states or coherent states and get the same answers, that's good enough. And then if people want to debate which is which, that's okay, because I can accept both sides. And then, so the density matrix can be written as a mixture of number states. What's interesting is if you stick to the point and you say, okay, I choose to believe that the density matrix can be decomposed into number states, then what happens? You know, do the calculations get incredibly complicated? In fact, when Terry and I were doing this work some time ago, one of the objections that came up was that the reason coherent states are better is because they're easier to use. And so the solution, which actually appears in this paper, was me, Steve, Terry, and Peter Knight, is to use something that we call an entangled coherent state representation, and it's to write the number states as a superposition of coherent states. Turns out that recently we've understood that this was actually discovered in a paper in 1967 by Aharonov and Suskind in looking at super selection rules. So they didn't make a big deal of it, but they did. They were writing about charged super selection, and what I'm going to show you, you know, once we've done it, we look back, we can see an equation in their paper that shows the same thing. And so the idea here is simply that if you choose to work with number states, you say that number states are somehow, I'm going to choose, so if I want to start an argument with quantum optics, I say I believe number states are real, coherent states aren't. Then I have to be able to do the calculations, or everybody thinks it's not valid. So the basic thing you do is you say, okay, if I'm going to believe in a number state, and I know coherent states are easier to use, then what I'm going to do is to write the number state as the superposition of coherent states. And I have a lot of choice because the coherent states are form an overcomplete basis. And a very nice way to write the number state is as a superposition of coherent states on the circle. Now what I've done is to write, this represents the number state. These are the coherent states on a circle. There's some phase-dependent term. In reality, I could write root m. The way I've drawn it was that m equals n, so the coherent states are centered on that circle that represents the number state. But I don't need to. M can be changed. So I can write a number state as a superposition of states, of coherent states on a different circle. Okay, but once you do this, if you say that you believe in number states, and you write it down as a superposition of coherent states on a circle, it turns out that the calculations are almost as easy as working with number states directly, except you just have to remember to integrate. And it turns out that the quantity that you integrate over is the global time or global phase that isn't necessarily regarded as physical anyway. So working with number states actually is no harder than coherent states, except for the effort of writing an integral, but it doesn't take anything. And so what happens, what's interesting, is if you then take the product of two number states, you can then write it as a double integral over a product of two coherent states. And then when you change variables, you get a phi 1 minus phi 2, which is the difference phase, and that's the synchronization. So, and then there's a sum phase, phi 1 plus phi 2. So when you take two number states like this, and write it in a form that you have a product of two coherent states and a double integral, switch to the sum and difference. The difference is your synchronization. That's the one that tells you that you've got a phase locking that can take place. And then there's a phase sum, which is the global phase that's not considered to be physical anyway. And so what we do, what you can see when you write it that way, is you just see a phase locking term that effectively gets built very simply in this formalism. And again, this expression is written in a slightly different way in Aharonov and Suskind from 1967. So we figured this out, but then a lot of times things have been figured out before, you just don't know it. Okay, so that's some background. And I'll show you one of the things it does. So just to introduce it is there's a, oh.
Wait, it's a problem that one is not n equal n, so what happens if n becomes very small, for instance?
Then you get a, the, you have to add up the, okay, so if I go back up here, there's a.
It collapses to a single state.
Pardon me?
It essentially goes to a single state, only it's n.
Oh, you mean if you take the circle to a zero radius?
Yes.
You get oscillatory terms, but, I mean, I don't know how to say it, like, it turns out it's perfectly valid to write it's valid to write as the circle gets smaller and smaller. I don't know what happens if the radius goes to zero. But you just have to be careful. There's a phase dependent coefficient. So, I can go over it later. I don't know if that question. Okay, so we have that thing. Okay, so this is considered to be an interesting problem in the field. It's the question of whether two number states can interfere. And there's a lot of debate about this, and there's even textbooks that say they can't, and all that stuff. But, you know, if you really start thinking about whether two number states can interfere, so what we're picturing over here is two number states, and we have to have some physical context for the number state. So we're thinking of a number state prepared in a cavity. So you have a cavity, which is a finite system and a finite boundary, and then the end photons is really some fixed, well-defined fixed level of energy excitation in a particular cavity mode, and then one of the mirrors is going to be leaky, and so the energy is going to come out, and the energy is going to come out here, and then the question is, will you see interference? And really the answer is both yes and no. It depends on how you phrase the problem. But in the way that we're phrasing it, which I think is the practical way, the answer is yes. And the way that you can see it very simply is that what you can do is just consider a certain amount of leakage that takes place. They hit the detectors, and what's going to happen if you write this in an entangled coherent state representation is that you find that your coherent states become slightly depleted as of leak cell. It's very easy to work on cavity leakage using coherent states. And then you're going to get an update that is a function of phi 1 and phi 2, that's the global phase term. And what's going to happen is you start off initially in a completely flat distribution in both sum and difference, and as the detection process takes place, and A and B represent the number of photons actually detected at the two poles. So as you continue to detect photons, you wind up with the narrowing of the phase difference, and this is like a phase locking mechanism. And so it turns out very easy to think about it this way. People have discussed this issue before, both in the context of Bose-Einstein condensates and in optical fields. But I think the calculation using these entangled coherent states makes it very simple to see the two number states interfere. It's not that this is the first time we see it, but I think it's nice it pops out very quickly. Okay, Andrew.
May I ask a question, sir? Isn't that the same as having two cavities which actually connected
or off to each other,
instead of thinking of n photons in the cavity,
or an excited
state or some atom, the same
quantum. Yes, okay.
You could
really
tell,
this is a very
experimental
situation. Yeah, okay, so in case people didn't hear, the question is, isn't this the same as just thinking of two atoms with some level of excitation n in each one, and then isn't this fairly standard? And this is like a phase locking, is that right? Yeah, exactly. So it is the same as that. It's, you know, for people who've been in quantum optics for a while, you know, and think about this, we understand it. And so I'm not claiming that it's anything new. I'm just showing this as an example of how the entangled coherent states can help to see the calculation very quickly. But people do it. Often people work in the number state, and then what you find is when you start detecting, because the beam splitter imposes some binomial distribution of which way the photons go, and you update, you wind up, if you get a photon here, you can get n minus 1 and n, or n and n minus 1, and this is probably the calculation you're thinking of. And then you can also see the coherence because you get, you know, you wind up having interference term between whether the photon came from there or there. So yeah, this is an old result, but it's a new way of looking at it. Okay, and then what happens is you find it gets more and more peaked, and then eventually it gets peaked at some delta, and so you get a completely good phase locking from the end. And again, that's our little phase locking. Okay, so now, so this gives you an idea of these entangled coherent states. It's some background, but I've only talked about bosons, and you know, we want to move on to fermions. And So we're going to move beyond that to just talk about issues with photons and coherence and what it means to actually be coherence. And I like the operational approach to thinking about things. So in the operational approach, we have to start thinking about what the measurements are before we talk about calculations. It's the same thing up here. We're talking about whether two number states can interfere, or two systems that are prepared in number states can interfere. We've been careful to construct a physical model, an operational method of being able to tell whether it happens. And once you do that, then it becomes fairly clear that they will interfere. And so what we're looking at more generally is just the question of whether there's coherence in the system. And so the way that we've been thinking about this in terms of operational coherence is in terms of correlation functions. And the correlation functions are used in quantum optics because in quantum optics, even talking about whether a state is coherent or not, so a bosonic state is coherent, is done in terms of correlation or coherence functions. And if you look at the properties in electronic systems, they're also this set of correlation functions. And then it turns out that if you calculate the set of all quantum optics, you calculate the set of all coherence functions, then that will determine what your state is. And the same applies to the fermionic systems. It doesn't tell you everything. So if you try to associate, say, the phase of a laser with the coherence functions, it doesn't emerge. But if you care about synchronization, the relative phase and how stable that is, that does emerge from these coherence functions. So by adopting an operational approach in terms of correlation functions, we're able to think about, it gives another way to think about shared frames, you know, that you can look at the mutual coherence of two beams. And so it gives it a perspective of this, you know, another perspective on the problem. Okay, then what we did, this goes back to the work that I did with Steve and Dan Model and Oliver and Lee. What we did is we went back and we figured, okay, we're going to have to sacrifice some properties from coherence that we have with quantum optics. So we have, in quantum optics, we deal with bosons. And if we want to track over to fermions, we need to come up with the appropriate correlation functions. And there's some ambiguity as to which correlation functions to pick. And we also went back to Glauber's work 41 years ago. And we Glauber defines coherence. And what we decided to do was to take what he wrote and break it up into two steps. And then there's two criteria. One is weak coherence, and the other is strong coherence. So in the standard work, it's called coherent. The coherent states are coherent, and their definitions are coherent. The weak coherence condition simply is that the normalized correlation functions are unity. So if I, and again, go back to what John Smolin told us about yesterday, if I write the output of a laser as a mixture of coherent states over all phases, or equivalently as a Poissonian mixture of number states, then this condition can be satisfied. So in the weak sense, the laser puts out a coherent state. So the way I think about it now, after years we've been talking about this, is, yeah, okay, a laser puts out a coherent state in the sense that it's weakly coherent. So I think of this now as a weakly coherent state. Then the strong coherence condition is that the correlation functions factorize for all orders over the entire spatial domain. And the spatial domain is just the physical space over which your light field exists. So you can ask questions about it. And so if you want the factorization over the entire spatial domain, then that would be the strong coherence. And that's very much tied to the clock concept, that if it factorizes, then you get the coherent states. The nice thing about the coherent states is when you let it evolve under the free Hamiltonian, it just evolves in the way you want a clock to behave. So if I think of a pendulum clock swinging back and forth, it's periodic. And having this strong coherence condition really gives me a sense that the clock is the laser's clock.
So I'm really elementary here. So what's the heuristic for doing that?
So the question: what is the heuristic notion of these mathematical definitions?
Things together in phase space.
Pardon?
It's
so you're asking about a heuristic understanding of the weak and strong coherence, or the correlation functions, or?
Well, sure.
Okay. So weak coherence is So the coherence is a correlation function. And what you're looking for, okay, so here's the way to do it. There are different orders of these coherence functions, and I'll go into it more later, but I'll tell you now. So the lowest order of coherence is really telling you something about interferometry. So if I take a beam, I split it and recombine and have different path lengths, and then I look at the interference effect, say the visibility, then the weak coherence is telling me how well that will interfere. So if it satisfies the condition that the normalized correlation functions are unity everywhere, then this means that I could do perfect interferometry with arbitrarily long delays within the constraints of whatever that spatial domain is. If I then go from the first to the second order, this is telling me about the Hambury-Brown twist effect, which was done in the 1950s in the context of astronomy, studying distant stars. And this is telling, so the second order is telling you essentially about anti-bunching. So if you are bunching, anti-bunching, and Poissonian statistics. So your second order is telling you something about that. Your even orders are telling you about statistics of your photons. Your odd orders can tell you about that, but also about the mutual coherence in the sense of phase, of phase locking. And so, but normally all we ever care about in typical experiments are first and second order, the, how well we can do interference and what our statistics are like. So that tells you that. But then the strong factorization is really, now the separation of weak and strong is, you know, it's something that we, Steve and Yoshi and Will and I talked about, but it's not common in the literature, and this is the one that really gives you independent clock-like behavior. And, okay, is that up? Okay. So those are the different functions. And then, of course, what we're interested in here is whether we can carry these notions over to electrons. So in order to go over to electron systems, we're trying to adopt the correlation function approach and these notions of factorization, et cetera, and trying to address the issue. Okay, then once we do this, and if we apply both the weak and the strong condition, then we can get coherent states of light. Now, the subject of coherent states is slightly complicated because there are different definitions of coherent states. With light, it turns out that every definition I know of what would be defined to be a coherent state all merge. So if you wanted to define a coherent state to be an eigenstate of some Lorentz operator in an algebra, if you wanted to define it to be in the Perelmov sense, some group operation on some, say, minimum uncertainty state, or whatever, then the coherent state obeys those properties. It's a minimum uncertainty state, it's a displaced vacuum, it's an eigenstate, the annihilation operator. And then you go to other systems, you have to sacrifice certain things. And what you sacrifice means that you're sacrificing some property of an optical field that might be, you know, might be important. And so the issue of a clock and how clocks behave could be sacrifices you make by not constructing the right state. So we're interested in whether there exists a right state and what it would look like if you had it. But in what we're talking about, and certainly the coherence conditions here, they don't care about displaced vacuum. What matters is it's an eigenstate of the annihilation operator. So the strong coherence is associated with the factorization of the correlation function. And this one, this one factorizes because the coherent state is an eigenstate of the annihilation operator. But there's another beautiful property that's associated with this. And this is actually really important. It's that if you take two coherent states and mix them at a beam splitter, the output will, again, be two coherent states. So coherent states are unique in that they're the only, that the product of two coherent states is transformed to a product of two coherent states by a beam splitter. And we tend to take this for granted. It's actually highlighted in Glauber's paper. And we tend to take this for granted, but in trying to generalize to other systems, this turns out to be a major impediment in trying to generalize it. And the reason it's so important is because we don't think about this often from a theoretical perspective, but it's important in an experimental perspective, and this is that when you create a field, you have certain modes. I think this goes to Nicholas' question about, you know, atom with n states and so on. You have a set of modes for whatever particular system you have, and then you need to think about that. Then you have your propagation modes, and you have your detector modes. And the different modes, you have to do a coupling. There's a linear coupling between the modes at each stage of the processing. And the mode coupling is simply writing beam splitter transformations. And so if you start off with a source that's producing coherent states of the source modes, then you go to your propagation modes, There's still product of coherent states is product of coherent states. And then your detector picks it up, you transfer to detector modes, and there's still coherent states. And then if you say, well, your detector has some window and some life, some window time and some spatial area and so on, then you just talk about a detector efficiency. And what you're really saying is the modes don't match, but product states, but product states, you throw some of them away, and then it's kind of easy to think about what's going on. When you go to other systems and you care about translating modes from one step to the next, then the and not having this property is creates difficulties. And we find the difficulties difficulties come up in a lot of different ways. Okay, and then another thing about photons, and this I think the consensus is building that which is sure that we don't have a way to produce coherent states at alpha frequencies currently. So, yeah.
I'm very surprised by these statements because from 50 years ago, in classical optical communication, there was a big field called European communication, and these people were actually producing a paper of and they had no cross and something like that. They go to Google that. The reason they didn't really support a commercial success is because of the technology of the optical.
So what you're saying, okay, well, maybe first of all, I'll clarify the statement. When I'm saying the coherent states, I mean the coherent states is eigenstates of the annihilation operator, but in the sense of being weakly coherent, then and satisfying the coherence functions, I can accept that that's been done. So I guess what you're saying you're surprised by is if I'm saying that that we don't have the way to produce the coherent state in the strong coherent sense as an eigenstate of the annihilation operator. That's what you're, is that what you're questioning?
Because I think people have to ask people to have a foundation for it. They suddenly have a source, they have another pyramid of fiber, they have a local oscillator, and they could read into signals and read out oscillation.
What frequency were they working with? Oh, 1.5 microns. So it's still up in the.
It is a frequency.
Do you want to take questions on this now or wait for the end?
It's more fun to talk now.
Okay. So, we see questions then. So,
oh, but are you answering Nicholas first?
It's all like exactly the same. So, given your statement then, when in the future do you think it will be possible to produce?
Oh, so you're moving on. You're not answering the question of what was done 15 years ago. You're now saying,
but it's all the same issue.
Well, okay, so going back to...
Maybe we can ask a question, but what should be done in order to demonstrate coherent states?
Yeah.
Well, okay, so you're saying that in the experiment 15 years ago, they had a local oscillator, and I need to understand how the local oscillator was constructed. So
if you just say how, in your ideal world in the future, how it will be possible to build, and what will be different.
Okay, but I'm doing them in the order the questions have arisen, and therefore I'm taking the priority, speaker's priority, and I'm first asking how it was done 15 years ago.
But it was a long process data, so we can put a laser, we can outside rating to make it more
difficult. There's a long process data in
the most.
Okay. So, okay, then I go to your question. I mean, the point I'm making here is meant to diffuse a controversy, not to create one. But the idea that, you know, I could say a laser is coherent in the weak sense or the strong sense. And so the question you guys are asking is, what does it mean? You know, what would be needed to have it in the strong sense? And so in the weak sense, provided that it's stable, the phase is stable enough, then I can split it off, recombine. Have an interference effect, etc. So if you think of a local oscillator as being derived from the same beam and achieved by an interferometric procedure, then I would say that convinces me that I have a coherent state in the weak coherent sense. And if you're able to construct an independent local oscillator, so the example that's always come up over the years is, you know, I hold a charged particle and move it up and down, so I have my local oscillator, say it was generated, doesn't have to be, but it was generated by mechanical or electromechanical means, and then I can lock to that and it's independent, then I guess we're to the strong components.
Well,
Can you explain why a mechanical device is a clock, but a conventional laser is not? I mean, you say you're trying to defuse it in proxy, but you're putting up a statement which isn't exactly the contrary of what I was arguing in my paper, so you can hardly expect to get away with it.
Do you want to come up here? So the problem, the way I look at it is strictly in terms of the coherence function. So I understand the point that you put forward, Howard, on where do you do the cup? You know, if you do a radio frequency, you have an independent local oscillator. Optically, you split it off. A laser performs the clock and all the rest. And so in that sense, I think it's legitimate to discuss the coherent states in terms of strong coherence. And in that sense, it crosses the boundaries. But in the question of whether, if you can only demonstrate in terms of the coherence functions that you have a weak coherence, so you know, it depends what you write in. If you write every correlation function, you write in your operators, you can come up with some detection means, some source means, then satisfying all the coherence functions just proves weak coherence. Then you have to go a bit beyond to have strong coherence. And strong coherence could be done in terms of an independent local oscillator. So I don't think we're going to agree on this.
Well, why don't you just remove that last point from your slide and then you won't get into argument?
Because I like arguments. Okay, so now on to the real. Oh, there's a question? Okay, so I hope everybody heard what Danny said, because I don't want to repeat the whole thing. But the answer is yes. That's why I'm not going to follow Howard's advice in taking the statement off. But I think that, you know, if I say that lasers put out coherent states of a weak coherent sense, and then there's the issue of strong coherence and demonstrating as I say, and then whether people think they've done it or not could be a sociological issue of consensus.
Okay. Tell us what should be done to demonstrate the existence of coherent states.
Okay, so you want me to set up, I'm back in a set. So what would be done in an experiment to demonstrate the coherent state? Well, Terry's here too, somewhere in the back of this. He might have a different point of view about this, but I mean, to me, I think that if, in a practical sense, if they're independent local oscillators, so they're constructed independent, basically clocks, it's a reference frame right here. So if you have an independent clock and you...
And why is a laser not a clock?
A laser can function as a clock if it's independent, but let's remember I said the word independent.
So then why do you say the laser can be a clock? Why do you say that there's no use in your state at the present time?
No, if it's done with an independent laser.
Well, I think that was done 15 years ago. Because
two lasers need different power supplies.
Yeah, that were based on.
Power supplies.
But, okay, I'll just say one thing about the T5. But certainly, I showed this diagram, two number states interfering in phase locking, and how you can understand what goes on here. So having two independent supplies that leads to a coherence effect doesn't prove to me that they're incoherent states. But, you know, I think we're debating a semantic issue.
Well,
is this a clock? Can you call this a clock?
What kind of experiment do I need to do to convince you of the existence of coherent states?
Well, I don't have an answer. But Connor,
I'm just going to make a comment about the future. Not for this, except the problem for the termination of earlier error of place. In the language of this workshop, you effectively have two reference frames. The first reference is a net frame of some reference classes. The first reference frame is when the electric, the envelope of the electric field is keys, and the other is when the electric field itself is not an entangle. So what you can do, you can try to fix modes and entangles with respect to the envelope of the classes, so that you can make sure that at any time your envelope keeps to when the nodes for the electric field.
So that's fixing one properly.
Yeah, at the end of the day, I'm happy with this. This is one thing.
Well, I guess that there's nothing more to do because I think that was the main question about how you made the first pulse coherent. What is it that made the envelope coherent? The timing of that coherent?
Well, this is defined by the cavity around your time. You can work it to a radio frequency.
And what makes a radio frequency more coherent than a laser?
Well, it can be external source that you can share. You can have independent sources of radio frequency.
But they can have independent sources of optical light as well.
Yeah, that is.
So what's the difference?
Okay, so can we just agree to disagree for the moment, and then I'll move on, because this actually isn't the point of the talk. So, okay, but I think people here are aware that there's still a controversy. And this is not what I'm seeking in this instance, because I think in talking about weak and strong, if you have an in this final word on it, if the laser functions as a clock independently, then we can satisfy the strong coherence condition. So I'm merely putting up the framework. Okay, so what I want to do is to now move on to the electronic coherence issue. And so this is the work that Steve Bartlett and I did with group at Stanford. And what we wanted to do was first to come up with correlation functions that were connected with experiment. And actually, there's a little bit of controversy in the literature for the electron gases as to what should even be the appropriate correlation function. So in quantum optics, our correlation functions are written in terms of correlations of positive or negative frequency components of the electric field. So it's really electric field, and that emerges because we all accept the Glauber detection theory that we can think of ideal detectors as point dipoles. And so we write everything in terms of electric fields. The question with electrons is, so we want to relate the electron field at different points. And we can look at it a couple of different ways, and I'm going to look at both ways, but the one that we were looking at in terms of current functions, and this is just saying that if you perform detections of, if you want to look for interference effects and all that in electron systems, then what takes place is that your electron can have different momentum, K and K prime, it will raise or lower, it will then transfer energy to the field, and then you might use photodetectors to be able to pick it up. So, and then you can write down the mode functions field. And so we refer to these as current operators. And the current operators, so you can see what goes on. These are fermionic. So you annihilate an electron with momentum k, you're able with momentum k prime, and then and there's a mode function. And so the idea here is that we want to then break it up. And we break it up here. There's a frequency component, which is just omega k minus a negative k prime, really. And then we break it up into positive and negative frequency components, and we start working on correlation functions in that way. So one approach to addressing the coherence issues, and this gets to the operational again, is we write down the operational, we write down these correlation functions to try to get some operational approach to coherence. And then this work I won't go into, it's on the archive. So this has a number of issues that arise. Some of the issues will arise when I look at a different type of correlation function. One of the problems with this particular method is that with quantum optics, if I put an upper bound on the number of photons in the system, then my GNs, these high-order correlation functions, will terminate, at some level. So that if I have n photons in the system, I don't see higher-order correlations simply because I need more detectors. And I've used them all up in the field. So this termination. This system, because you're really looking for photons of light, picking those up, then you can actually get an electron will deliver a couple of photons. So there, in a practical sense, I think this is a very good correlation function to study in order to try to connect coherence to electronic systems in a practical sense. But from a theoretical point of view, it does have some problems. Okay, so I guess you've done this earlier, but what I want to talk about now is the correlation function. So we've talked about it a bit before, and over here, what I'm writing down is an expression for the correlation function. So with quantum optics, we can use the electric field. We have psi dagger, like positive and negative frequency components of the field in question. And I'm just writing it down in this way because I'm now writing down the correlation function in a way that I can express it for bosonic and Fermi fields. And so if I write it like this, so this, the x's and y's just represent different positions in my spatial domain for my field, could be electrons and photons. And if I write the correlation function in this way, not the way before, now I have something that's identical between, identical formalism between the electron and photon system. But here, these operators, you know, they're fermionic, they have different, they have anti-commutation properties. So what we do is we do the typical thing. We then replace the field by fermionic modes. Replace the field by a modal decomposition. So it's a Fourier decomposition. And the AKs are now the Fourier coefficients, which we second quantize. And these are the mode, we're now moving to modes instead of spatial picture. And then built in each mode is single energy. Okay, the nice thing about doing this is it doesn't matter if you have fermions or bosons, your G's terminate after some level. So if you only have n particles, the correlation functions for n greater than n terminate. And so, I kind of like that physical property, it helps to give an interpretation of these correlation functions. And then we know that for photons, if these correlation functions factorize, then we have a coherence property that's met. And I mentioned this before, but here's an expression. So if I write down these capital G's in terms of these correlation functions, then we define these little G's as, so it's Glauber's notation. The little G's are just normalized version of the big G's, and this is why if the coherence functions are all equal to 1, well, if you get factorization, then the coherence functions are always equal to 1. See the factorization right there, and then you're able to see that the you're able to obtain coherence. But the factorization condition isn't necessarily sufficient. Okay, and then, for example, the G1, we can understand in terms of the basic double slit experiment, have plane waves coming in, for example, passing through the two slits. And if the G1 is equal to 1 everywhere, then we're guaranteed to have 100% visibility. So this is a practical sense of coherence. And if we have a factorization, then we can start talking about independent beams going in. So it relates to controversy, but I don't feel like arguing at the moment. Okay. So now what I want to address, the issue of factorization for electronic beams. And what we find, first of all, just looking at this GN, is that factorization is not possible if for n greater than 1 for any state size. So whereas with photons, it can happen. What takes place over here, mathematically, is that as you try to, if you go to positions of electrons that are very close together, then they meet, your functions go to 0 at those points. And so if you want factorization and your functions go to 0, that's a problem. And so in trying to define coherence, and a number of people might have expected this, that having the exclusion principle affects how well you can get it. And a lot of people have different ways of thinking why electronic beams might not be coherent. And so we decided to start doing plots. You know, we decided to do things numerically for different systems. I don't give you any of the details yet of the sort of calculations we're doing, just show you a typical graph that we see for a second order correlation function. And we've got x and y along the two axes. And along the x equals y, oh yeah, this is a x and x, y, y, x. So along the x equals y, it goes to 0. And the function's not factorizable. It might be factorizable over a tiny, tiny domain in these systems, but it's not factorizable overall. So looking at the G2, which is related to the anti-bunching, you're seeing some sort of anti-bunching or exclusion principle taking place over here. And so if, for n greater than 1, if your correlation function factorizes, then everywhere, then it implies that the correlation function passes to 0. So there's a problem both, we find a problem both in terms of the G2 that we constructed in a more practical sense related to current operators, and also in a more theoretical sense of writing it in terms of thermodynamic field operators, that the Gn for n greater than 1 factorizes. But in terms of clocks and mutual coherence in that, G1 is sufficient. And so the question in terms of how we can talk about clocks and fermions are related to whether G1 will factorize. So now we're looking for the strong coherence condition of factorization. And so we pose a question which is similar to one of quantum optics about coherent states. So we're thinking, can we write a coherent state? And writing a coherent state of fermions, now this is writing it down. It's not asking the questions of can we make this physically. It's simply, can we write down a coherent state for electrons that would behave in the way we would want coherent states to behave? And the issue here is, so we did it in a very natural way. We simply take a displacement of the no electron state. And in writing it in this fashion, it's very similar to what you think of with qubits. So zero can be no electron, one is an electron. You can't have more than one electron per mode. There's an exclusion principle. And so it's really like just creating a qubit state. And so we were thinking this could be a good coherent state. And then if we go to more than one mode, we just adopt the quantum optics type approach of writing a displacement of the zero. The problem is that with fermions, you're limited to at most one particle per mode. And so what we did was we just took the quantum optics approach for a multimode system and just generalized the multimode displacement. So if I take a coherent state in photons and write it in terms of many modes, then I can write down the state in that fashion. And so this would look the same for bosons and fermions, except these become fermionic operators. And then there's only single and one vacuum and single particle contributions overall. So if I write this, I now have a superposition of 0 and 1 in every mode as long as gamma k is not 0. There are problems in doing this, and the problem is that fermions satisfy anti-commutation relations that's very much associated with the exclusion principle. And so the problem is that when you write this operator, you have to be very careful with order. And so in writing this, if you write this e to the sum, and then you write it as a product of e to the whatever for each mode, if you write it in different orders, you get different answers. And we start to find this problem just doing our calculations. So again, just to get an understanding of it, we decided to calculate correlation functions for different orderings. Now, physically, it's hard to imagine how this ordering would emerge. And yet, in terms of correlation functions, the ordering is extremely important. Picking a different ordering will change the coherence properties. So in order to do the numerical work, what we did, we kept the number of modes finite, and we're thinking of a cone, so I'm going to call this a cone. And because it's a multimode system, we're picking a bandwidth. So here we're looking at the wave number k. We've got a lower and an upper limit, so this represents our bandwidth. We're going to pick 40 different modes, each one equally contributing and equally spaced. And so we have 40 modes, so there's AKs, K numbers from 1 to 40, sorry. And we're going to keep the occupation number very small, so we're going to put a total of 1.1 particles spread over 40 modes, and so I'm going to call these different modal ones T, and this is the cone, so I can use that terminology or what it means. And then what we did was we said, let's prepare just the ordered case, and the ordered case is simply that we apply so we've done the displacement, we write it out as a product of operators, and we're creating a superposition of 0 and 1 electron in the nth mode. This is creating a superposition of 0 and 1 in the second mode, and so on. And this is done in an order, just in the order, and then what we did was we just took a random permutation of the 40 modes and then constructed psi random. And then we just calculate correlation functions and look at what happens. And so over here, this is G1. So remember, we've written off looking at higher than G1. And we're looking at G1 simply because we're trying to understand coherence for electron systems. And the first graph here is that order case. So we have the ordering, the 40th tooth on the comb down the first tooth on the comb. And here, this is the randomly ordered one. It turns out that if you randomly order, you get better results. Now, a little bit of thought tells you why, because we've picked equally spaced teeth of equal heights, and so there's interference effects that are taking place. If we chose a randomized comb with randomized heights, then things might look like this. But in the context of what we're doing, this what the reason that these are different is not just the ordering, but it's because we've selected a case of a comb, which is going to give a very different result. But what happens is you can see quite the stark difference here of the difference between G1 for the ordered case, where you get all these interference effects, and the non-ordered case. And I need to explain to you the features of this. I'm almost out of time. So I'll just explain what's going on here. Is that what you're seeing, this is a contour plot. These are troughs. The troughs have a width and spacing. The width of the troughs is really related to the, inversely related to the bandwidth of the comb. And how far apart these things are is related to the distance between the teeth and the comb. So if we replace the comb, we go to an infinite number of modes and so on, then these just will spread out. So you'll get a broader range. And then what you find is it gets to be very close to factorizable over some small domain. So as long as you keep the domain small compared to the distance between the troughs and so on, then in some practical sense, you can talk about coherence. And you want to do this, because I mean, when I read the literature on electrons, electron beams, people talk about coherent beams. And so what you can see here is some way that the coherence would emerge out of calculating the G1. In this case, you don't have it. And so there's an issue about, if you talk about that and you worry about the ordering of the modes, then it's a problem. So these are weak. Remember, it was 1.1 particles over 40 modes. Even for weak states, the order matters. And the factorization occurs in a small domain, where small is related to the properties of the bandwidth and the space and the frequencies. Just to compare, so actually, let me tell you something. The features that happen over here don't happen with the bosonic case. And we wanted to separate two issues. One is the exclusion principle. And so the exclusion principle is going to affect the degree of coherence, but also the fact that you don't get more than one electron per mode. So if you think of one of the nice properties of photons, the coherent state is an eigenstate of the annihilation operator. So when you apply the annihilation operator and you move your 1 to a 0, you move a 2 to a 1 in exactly the right ratio. And so what we did was we compared it to the bosonic case, except we said, let's take 40 modes, 1.1 particles, and we'll truncate a 2. So we're writing a truncated coherent state that's no longer an eigenstate, and this is the bosonic case. First thing, of course, is that the order doesn't matter. Secondly, you can still see the troughs. They're much better. So with the bosonic case, it's very, very flat. So the factorizability is excellent. And then it goes over to here. So the difference between these features and these features, and we've done, this is actually 80 modes, so whereas before it was 40, so it's not totally a fair comparison. But what we find is that we find there is a difference between whatever ordering we pick for the Fermionic case and the bosonic case, and we feel that the difference that we see is not due to truncate, not due to the coherent state being not being an eigenstate of the annihilation operator, but rather that the there's a truncation issue that comes in, which gets smaller and smaller as we go to fewer particles over more modes. Okay, so then the problem, so I've been saying here, is that that we don't have an eigenstate of the annihilation operator for the fermion case, and that's that leads to some of the problems which we managed to sort out, and then we have, then we have other issues that come in because of the exclusion principle and the ordering of anti-commutation relations that makes it harder to find coherence. And another problem, this is the one I said at the beginning, which I don't have time to go into, is about the idea that if we do a mode mixing that takes place, the mode mixing doesn't work very well. The whatever coherence states we construct, there's no operator we found that will map a product to a product. Okay, so I won't do this one. I'll just mention very briefly that in this case, what we decided to do was say, let's look at it very generally. What's the most general superposition state we can write in terms of sectors? And actually, I just want to make one point here, that in quantum optics, we like to think in terms of coherent states. And it's a very convenient way to think. When you talk to people in the electron community, they're about super selections. I have not talked to anybody who works seriously in the field that doesn't tell me that the number of electrons in the system is absolutely definite. Why? Because of charge and mass. And so, in even writing something that's a superposition of numbers of electrons. Now, because in photon, with photons, we can say number and mode. So I think of these as number sectors. And a number sector is a fixed number of electrons across many modes. And in the electron community, even writing this down is heresy, because the super selection rule is somehow inbuilt in the entire program of training. And so, but we wrote this down and we started to study it, and of course we found a number of problems. One, that what we expected at the beginning, we don't have any way of creating this from a fixed number of electrons, even zero electrons, any good method of writing a set of unitary gates or something like that. And then we also found problems with ordering and various other things that emerge when we try to come up with physical reasons for it. Okay, so I'm going to finish very quickly in something that we just started looking at, actually this week before I came over. And so we went back and looked at some work by Kahle and Blauber that came out, I think, last year. And in that one, they're talking about coherent states, and electron coherent states, or fermionic coherent states, in terms of Grassmann variables. And Steve and I have talked about this before, and looking at it, we've tended to avoid the Grassmann variables, primarily because we don't really have any physical meaning for them. But they have a lot of beautiful mathematical properties. So a lot of the problems that we run into, in terms of coherent states being eigenstates or how they behave with beam splitters and so on, they go away when you start working with the Grassmann variables. And I won't go through all the properties. The Grassmann variables anticommute. The square is zero, of course. And they also anticommute with the annihilation operator. That's the fermionic annihilation operator. So the Grassmann variables have this property that it buries all the anticommutation relations in some number that acts as your parameter. So whereas with quantum optics, when we write a coherent state and talk about a complex number alpha, then alpha is alpha is a complex number. The argument of alpha is the phase or the time variable. But when you write it in terms of electrons and you start using the Grassmann variables, then you're parameterizing in terms of the Grassmann variable. So I haven't had time to understand that. I've gone through the literature looking for any hint of how to think about Grassmann variables from a practical point of view and haven't found one. And maybe there isn't one. But anyway, so they have very nice properties that take place. The anticommutation relations are buried inside this Grassmann variable, and they behave very beautifully at the beam splitter. So probably the next step we're going to do is to go back and try to construct a decent coherence theory in terms of Grassmann variables. Probably what will emerge is a mathematical formalism that I don't see how we're going to connect to physics, but at least it will have some nice properties. And then there's various calculations you can do to check it. The factorization condition is met, so in the sense of that I think about coherence, the coherence conditions are met. It agrees with universal anti-bunching, so the anti-bunching properties are built in because of the Grassmann variables. But they have a problem, so again, a lot of this is in Kahle and Glauber's work. The problem is that when you start working out expectation values of what we believe are Hermitian variables, operators, they're not real. And so once you start to calculate, so you think, okay, you're going to go and start calculating correlations or expectation values, you kind of want real numbers, at least I do, because that's, I want my meters, whatever they're going to register some real number. And I don't understand when they register Grassmann numbers. Okay, so the conclusions are the coherence is approached operationally in terms of coherence functions. And this is why I'm kind of tired of the debate about whether, I don't mind putting out the statement I'm getting. I think it's good to have the arguments about coherence states, but actually, I don't really want to argue because I don't really disagree with the statements that Nicola and Howard are making. And so it's good to argue and then it's good to agree in the end. So the statements, and I think other people in the room need to think about this. So the way I like to think about it is operationally in terms of coherence functions. And I think then when you work on coherence functions, you can sort it out. The coherent states are quite beautiful because if you have coherent states, then you have clocks. And I think everybody agrees on that. And then the question here is, how do we then find out where the clocks emerge and how they emerge from coherence functions? And then we're just trying to apply it to fermions. And what we've been finding is that if we try to write down coherence functions in terms of current correlators, and we have ordering problems, and all kinds of problems emerge in trying to do coherence theory for electrons, even though people talk sensibly about coherent electron beams. But if we start using Grassmann variables, everything turns out very nice, but we don't understand what they mean. And the one thing I didn't cover here was the homodyne detection. And so because the G1 behaves so well over a small domain, and people talk about coherence of electron beams, it's very similar to what we do in quantum optics, that we can do autocorrelation. We can take a beam, split it, do something with one beam, use the other as a reference, and so think of this as a Hohmann detection, it's an autocorrelation. And so, provided that G1 is well behaved and restricted to that domain, then you do have a sense, you have this, that the G1 tells you that over a certain domain, you can talk about autocorrelation, and therefore, in some sense, clocks with fermions. Thanks.
So we have minus 1 minute for questions.
We don't have a negative question.
No, see, if anyone wants to ask a question, feel free.
We have a negative comment. I would like to read. I'd like to reframe what you're saying about this thing, say, just to make sure that I understood your point. If you have a watch, I have a watch. If you want to be tonight, what is important is the difference between the time indicated of the time. Now, the two photons is exactly the same problem, except of course it's different frequencies. But then the two photons, when we meet on a beam filter, what are they going to interfere constructively or destructively depends on their time difference, some phase difference. And it's not the absolute, the beam phase that counts. And